for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. The Senate opened debate on the financial regulatory bill after Republicans halted a three-day filibuster. Arizona's tough new immigration law was challenged by several groups, including some of the state's law enforcement and elected officials. And the spreading oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico could cause President Obama to reconsider expanded offshore oil and gas drilling. Joining me in the studio for our Friday News Roundup, Jerry Seib, The Wall Street Journal, Susan Page of USA Today, and Chris Saliza, author of The Fix on WashingtonPost.com, managing editor of a news section launched this week, PostPolitics.com. Congratulations to you, Chris.
Thank you, Diane.
So glad to have you all here. I want to let our listeners know they, too, are welcome. Please join us, 800-433-8850. So much to talk about today. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Join us on Facebook or Twitter. Let's talk about this massive oil spill, which really threatens to contaminate not only the water, the shoreline, the creatures who are there. The Navy has now been called in to help control it. Yesterday, estimates of just how much oil is leaking were upped fivefold. I want to understand why SWAT teams have been sent in. Jerry Seib, any thoughts?
Well, I'm not sure I know, but the logical explanation would be concern about terrorism. And, you know, we're probably at a point in American history where every disaster that's not a hurricane or anything short of a hurricane is going to be a disaster that raises questions about terrorism, and I suppose this one does in some people's minds. You know, there are lots of offshore oil platforms. One of the concerns in Homeland Security for the last several years has been terrorist groups finding new creative ways to stay one step ahead of the anti-terrorism forces in this country and around the world. So I suppose we're at that point where that's the question that logically arises.
And now the AP is reporting that two Air Force planes have been sent to the Mississippi. They're awaiting orders to start dumping chemicals on the oil spill threatening the coast while the government works to contain the spill, Susan.
You know, even if this isn't an incident of terrorism, and I think so far we don't have any signs that it is a big event. It's a big event environmentally. It looks like this may well be the biggest oil slick in American history, bigger than the Exxon Valdez. We're heading in that direction. We get a third of our oil production from the Gulf of Mexico, so it's got economic consequences. And, you know, I think it changes the climate entirely for the energy bill that's been stalled on the Hill already. I think it makes it even more difficult to proceed on that front. And that was something that the administration was very hopeful might be able to get done this year.
With offshore drilling.
Well, offshore drilling was a part of that. President Obama announced, I guess, about a month ago that he would propose expanded offshore drilling as a way to entice Republican support to that bill. I think it seems unlikely that that's a position the White House is going to hold to in the weeks ahead.
Chris, the president and the Secretary Napolitano used the phrase of national significance. Is that a term of art, or does it trigger certain reactions from the U.S. government?
I mean, I think it triggers certainly what we have done, which is sending, as you mentioned, Air Force, Navy. I think what they are doing is, this isn't, to borrow a poor cliche, this is an all-hands-on-deck situation. I think there is, Susan touched on this, I do think there is political peril here. The offshore drilling is the clearest and most obvious example of it, Diane. You saw David Axelrod, senior advisor at the White House, say we're halting the idea of any offshore drilling until we find out exactly what's happened here. The other thing to consider is the American public looks to the federal government to react in a competent way when something like this happens. George W. Bush, for all of his problems with Iraq and the Iraq War, clearly those damaged him. The thing that damaged him, I believe, more than anything else was his inept response to Hurricane Katrina. Now, this is a natural disaster versus, you know, potentially an error, a man-made error. Regardless, these are the sorts of things that people look to the government to help solve, and the government needs to show we are addressing this, we take it seriously, we understand the import here, and we are doing everything we can, not just to solve it in the short term, but to try and avoid it happening again.
But, Jerry, there is some criticism about how long it took President Obama to respond.
There has been, and I think you'll see a weekend in which there will be a full court press by the White House to make sure that that notion gets wiped out. I think the problem substantively for not just the White House but also for BP, the company, and probably local officials along the Gulf Coast was that it wasn't until yesterday that people realized this was significantly worse than thought. The flow of oil from the hole, because now it turns out there are two holes, is literally five times worse than was thought. So this went from being a really bad problem to a disastrous problem in basically 24 hours. And, you know, I think the other thing that, to go back to Chris's point, one of the things that this will do is, in an era in which people are complaining about too much government, too much regulation, people are going to say, why wasn't the government regulating this more? Because it does appear there was a blowout preventer mechanism that didn't work right on this rig, and probably a remote control shutoff that other rigs have that this one didn't have. That's what our reporting has shown. So there are some questions here that only regulators can address, and that's what people are going to look
for,
I think.
So compare this to the Exxon Valdez and what to responsibility the oil company itself could bear, Susan.
Well, in the aftermath of the Exxon Valdez, a law was passed in 1990 making it clear that the company involved, BP in this case, is responsible for the cost of the cleanup. We don't know how much that's going to be, but we know it was more than $1 billion for the Exxon Valdez. So a big financial burden. And when the administration was out yesterday talking about the cleanup, they repeatedly tried to make it clear that it's not taxpayers who at the end are going to be paying for this cleanup. It's the company involved.
And, you know, while this, Diane, isn't in the same, I know we're going to talk about financial regulatory from Wall Street, remember that there is a climate in this country that is very anti-big corporation, anti-big business. So the Obama administration, as Susan mentioned, the Obama administration is going to make sure that people know that the federal government will not bear the brunt of this, because, again, in a climate like this one, politically, economically, etc., the idea that BP may have dropped the ball in some real way on this, and then, okay, well, the federal government will come sweep in, and that will not fly. And the Obama administration understands that.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting. This is also a contrast to the Exxon Valdez. BP's making all the right noises at this point. They're saying, essentially, if something went wrong here, we want the government to come in and find out if there needs to be new regulation or more regulation, then that we won't stand in the way of that. That's, I think, in contrast to what I remember the Exxon corporate response, at least initially, being to the Valdez incident.
Jerry Seibert, the Wall Street Journal. Chris Salezza, he's editor and author of The Fix and managing editor of postpolitics.com at washingtonpost.com, and Susan Page of USA Today. Do call us, 800-433-8850. Chris, let's talk about that financial bill and why Republican senators gave up their filibuster.
They gave up their filibuster, Diane, because they realized that they had put themselves, whether purposely or I suspect not on purpose, into a box, that they were being painted as objectors to a bill that, if you believe the Washington Post ABC bill, the poll, two-thirds of the American public support the major provisions, things like bringing derivatives, these somewhat secretive trades to light, having some way to not have a bailout of these companies by the federal government. So politicians are politicians for a reason. They understand when they're on the wrong side of the American public. And I think Republicans wanted to say, we want to just make this bill better. It's not that we don't want to debate it. They realized after three votes that they were losing that argument politically. And in the old – in the Fisher cut bait model, they decided to cut bait and say, okay, let's debate this. Let's try and fix it or make it better in the amendment process. And that's what we are now into over the next several weeks in the Senate.
You know, Democrats would have been happy to have a vote every day from now to Election Day on this if Republicans wanted to continue to block moving to debate on it. And Republicans were a victim of from the Department of Bad Timing school, which was as they were debating this bill, you had these hearings in the Senate with the Goldman Sachs folks trying to defend themselves from these devastating emails that raise questions about whether they were trying to profit from the housing downturn, whether they were being straight with investors. So that really, I think, sealed the deal that this financial regulatory bill is going to move forward. It's not done yet. Some big issues still to be determined. But it, now at least it's on its way.
Well, you know, one of the problems here, leaving the politics aside, if we can, this is not a good way to fix the problems in this bill. That's the problem that I see with it. I mean, there are probably some things here that people in the center of both parties who actually know something about the subject would like to fine-tune. You could have either done that in the banking committee where people – senators, a smaller group of senators who actually know the subject would debate it. Or you can do it in a back room somewhere, and that's one way to get it done. At least you have people who know the subject there. That's not going on right now either. So they're going to try to fine-tune the bill on the Senate floor. That is not a good place to do delicate surgery.
Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal. We'll take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk further about financial reform. Take your questions, comments. Stay with us. Welcome back. Let's continue with our conversation about the financial reform bill and what Republicans got that they wanted, how it will proceed. Jerry Seib.
Well, what happened this week was that, as you know, as Chris was saying, I think Republicans decided they needed to get to a point where they could not be the obstructionist on this bill. They did that by saying, we got something that allows us to accept a debate on this floor. That something was the removal of a $50 billion fund that was written into the legislation that would be there to help the government regulators draw down a failing institution and shut it down without ripple effects in the economy. Now, this was the bailout fund, as Republicans came to call it, because they said if you have a $50 billion pot there, it will encourage banks to do risky things because they know there's a safety net in the form of $50 billion sitting in the Treasury that they know will be there to save them from themselves if they engage in risky behavior. That's gone away now.
But they called it a bailout, Jerry.
Right. Well, because the idea was if it's $50 billion, it will bail out bankers who do risky things because they know they won't have to go into bankruptcy court. The reason for the bailout fund is that when a big financial institution is failing, as we've seen, It tends to happen very quickly. It often happens over the weekend, and you have about 12 hours to decide how are you going to shut this thing down without having massive ripple effects through the economy. That was the reason for the fund. An alternative, which happens to be in the House bill, is simply to say, well, if that happens, the Treasury Department can borrow $50 billion from the Fed or from itself, and regulators can use that to do things like keep the lights on, keep people on the payroll, and pay off creditors while they shut down a Goldman Sachs or a Lehman Brothers or whoever it is. So there will be some funding mechanism to ensure that the government can do this thing, which everybody agrees is a good thing, which is do an orderly shutdown of a financial institution that's giant and failing.
And in fact, the White House supported the House version. The White House was not in favor of having this be an existing fund. So I think it was a fairly easy thing for Democrats to concede in the Senate. That gave Republicans a way to back off the limb they were on.
And what about the whole issue of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau?
Well, that is, you know, Diane, always in the Senate, you get over one hurdle to be faced with another hurdle, as we've seen over the years. There's just a lot of – we're in a probably a two-week period of debates, as Jerry mentioned, series of amendments, very public, probably not particularly productive process as it relates to bill. But the sticking point for Republicans remains this idea of creating this Consumer Financial Protection Agency. They argue that what you are essentially doing is giving this free rein that would have unlimited power, that it could, in the words of one senior Republican, use for social justice purposes. That is not loan based on credit, not loan based on sort of on the merits, but loan in order to accomplish social goals. So again, what both sides do in this, I think, is particularly when you're in the opposition, is you paint the absolute worst case scenario that there's a 0.000001% chance of happening to say, well, this could happen. And it's hard for the other side to say, well, no, it absolutely couldn't happen.
Well, you know, I think there's an interesting dynamic here in which the whole debate has kind of come full circle. As it started in the Senate, this was the thing Republicans were fixed on, was this Consumer Protection Agency. And then we got distracted by the bailout fund. And it turns out in the end, this is still the thing that most worries Republicans. I think their concerns are legitimate in the sense that when you're writing a bill and you're creating a new agency, you want to make sure it doesn't 10, 20 years from now run out of control and start doing things you didn't intend it to do, like tell banks, you know, you must give loans to these people. That's kind of what happened with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and created a housing bubble. So I think the concerns are legitimate, and I think reasonable people in a room could work out some safeguards to take care of that. Again, I go back to my concern about 100 senators on the floor of the Senate. Is that the small room where reasonable people can come up with a compromise that makes everybody comfortable?
And, of course, there'll be some amendments from the left, not just from Republicans,
yeah,
but from Bernie Sanders.
So how soon can we expect something on this?
I think that we're looking at about, as Chris was saying, about 2 weeks of debate before Senate action. And then, of course, it has to go back to the House. They have to have a version that both houses have passed that have been the, that are the
I
same.
I think it's important to understand the dynamic here, though, is way different than in the health care debate. In the health care debate, Republicans would have been happy if the final outcome was no and death. Nobody wants to get to no here. Everybody wants to get to yes. And that's a significantly different dynamic.
And I would just one thing. I think there's a similarity with the healthcare dynamic and maybe even more so, which is many legislators said nobody's read this bill on the healthcare bill. People don't understand it. The truth of the matter is you are dealing with complex financial regulation here that there are probably five. I defer to Jerry on this, but maybe there are five or ten people in that chamber in the Senate who have any detailed understanding of what's being done beyond the broadest outlines, which always makes for, and this is to Jerry's point, does not make for making the bill better. It tends to make for scoring political points via these amendments as opposed to actually offering amendments that would make real change.
But, you know, we get to the point where we're thinking about what will be the powers of this independent consumer agency. Let's not lose sight of we're on the path to the biggest overhaul of the way we regulate financial institutions since the period after the Great Depression. And this is an effort to avoid this crisis that we saw in 2008 that has been so devastating for so many Americans.
And as you said, Susan, going back to a week where you also had Goldman Sachs representatives appearing before the Senate and Senator Carl Levin getting bleeped over and over and over again for using the very word that rhymes with pretty that was in the Goldman Sachs memorandum in terms of what this deal was all about. How outrageous.
But it was as though the senators and the Goldman Sachs execs were from different planets. Because I did get the sense, and Jerry maybe could speak with more sophistication about this than I can, that the Goldman Sachs people didn't think they really did anything wrong. This is their job. They put together deals. They sell it to people with money. They don't have a sort of social obligation to be transparent.
And then they bet against it.
Well, you see, but you're absolutely right. This was like, was it men are from Mars, women are from Venus? Because the senators were looking for the Goldman Sachs people to address the question, well, was it right or wrong what you did? Was it good or bad? Was it fair or unfair? And they got blank stares. And because in the Goldman Sachs world, those are not questions that matter. You don't worry about right or wrong. You make markets. You find things that people want to sell. You find people who will buy them and take bets on them. And you make the market, and you make money from making the market. And that's your role in the universe. And you don't think about right or wrong. And so you don't write the mortgages. You don't decide who gets them. You just package them up, and you find somebody who's willing to buy them.
But isn't that where the critics of capitalism, as it currently is run, have a point to make?
Well, I think they have a point in the sense that if it gets too complicated, people bundle up mortgages and sell them to people who never understand or don't have a good look inside the bundle they've just bought. I'm not sure that's Goldman Sachs' job, frankly. That's probably the real complaint here has got to start with the people who wrote the mortgages in the first place and then knew they could dump them off in a market where nobody would pay much attention. That's a problem. I'm just not sure that's Goldman Sachs' problem.
But there are some rules of the road, and that Goldman Sachs now faces accusations from the SEC on civil charges of fraud. And we read in the papers this morning that federal prosecutors in New York are looking at the possibility of criminal charges as well.
And this is something that as soon as it became clear that it had been referred to the Justice Department, I got 10 emails, maybe more, from progressive from liberal organizations touting this. Again, they're the anti-corporatist strain in American politics. I think it ebbs and flows. It's always present, but is extremely strong from the AIG executive bonuses right through Fabulous Fab, who became the face of this controversy at Goldman Sachs. These are people, and I think Susan's point has to be reiterated. These are people and institutions that the average American simply does not understand. They don't know people like this. They don't understand why Goldman Sachs does what it does. But what they do feel is outrage at the idea that rich people, and whether this is, to Jerry's point, whether this is right or not, rich people are defrauding or fooling poor people to make more money for them and their rich friends. And that in politics is very, very powerful.
In the meantime, the firm's lobbying expenditure has gone up 72% from the same first quarter of last year. So what do you think could happen from both the SEC and the Justice Department?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that I take the Justice Department at Goldman Sachs thing too seriously. There's a fairly routine process in which if the SEC files a civil suit against somebody because they think they did something wrong in terms of the way the markets are supposed to work, they refer it to the Justice Department and say, you guys might want to look to see if you see something criminal here. I don't think you can read much into that. I do think this financial regulatory bill will pass, and I do think there's going to be, and this is going back to Chris's point, which is kind of not a legal issue but more a political and social one, I think there's going to be a debate about ethics on Wall Street. That's kind of a national debate, which is going to be, well, should you guys think about this more? You cannot be amoral given what just happened. I think that's very likely to occur. I don't know what form that takes, but I think there's probably a certain amount of self-regulation in Wall Street that may come out of this.
All right, let's turn to immigration. What's happening there with Arizona's decision to move forward with a law? Now the question is there going to be federal action on this as well? At first, you heard that President Obama said on board the plane, this may not be the right time. There may not be an appetite for this yet. A day or so later, you hear we're moving forward.
Well, President Obama said he wasn't sure there's an appetite in Congress now for a comprehensive immigration bill. And that is almost certainly the case. I don't think anybody could fairly look at the scene on Capitol Hill and say that there is a willingness to pass a major immigration bill. People are just too divided on it. However, he had very harsh words about this Arizona law, which would allow police to stop and question someone if they had any reasonable suspicion that person was an illegal immigrant.
How do you define reasonable?
Well, I think that will be a critical issue. And is this just an opening for racial profiling? Now, the supporters of the bill say it's not, because the bill says it can't be. You can't stop and question someone. You can't have this suspicion solely because of their race or ethnicity. But certainly it raises concerns about that. And we saw the first lawsuits filed yesterday against this bill. One question is whether the Justice Department will join these lawsuits, will try to take action themselves to block this law. I don't think that's been decided yet.
The politics of anything that happens in an election year, probably anything that happens in any year anymore, is fraught with politics. But certainly what happens in an election year and 6 months away from an election, it just has huge political implications. You know, I think Republicans, Diane, have rightly gotten the most attention in terms of how much of a bind does this put them in. Obviously, the Hispanic vote is growing rapidly in this country. George W. Bush, along with Karl Rove, his senior strategist, did everything that they could to appeal to Hispanic voters. He certainly did better than past Republican nominees. But in 2008, it reverted back to form, even though John McCain from Arizona, from a state, had been involved at least in part on the idea of comprehensive reform. But I think Democrats, too, remember that Democrats don't necessarily love this issue either. Lots of their members who sit in swing districts, these are culturally conservative districts. There's a special election next month in a southwestern Pennsylvania district. John Murtha held it for a very long time. This is a place where I'm not sure that bill would be particularly popular, in Democrats need to be aware of that.
Chris Delezza, he's managing editor of postpolitics.com, author of The Fix on WashingtonPost.com, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. Jerry.
You know, I also think there are some senators, moderate senators, who come from states where I'm not sure they want to have an immigration debate this year either. You know, and the unrealistic part of the politics of this, which Susan was referring to, are really very clear if you think about who is going to go get Republican votes for an immigration reform bill this year. I mean, somebody reminded me yesterday that George W. Bush and John McCain, not exactly big friends of each other, joined arms and tried really hard to get Republican votes back in the Bush years for an immigration reform bill like the one people are talking about now, and they couldn't find them. So I don't think in an election year with the Democrats in charge, there are a lot of Republican votes out there for this. And so I don't think this is going anywhere substantively. I think we're in political point scoring time.
I think that's right. I was at a breakfast yesterday with Texas Senator John Cornyn, who heads the Senate Campaign Committee for the Republicans. And he is a supporter of comprehensive immigration reform. You know, the attitudes in Texas are very different from the attitudes in Arizona. But he refused to criticize the Arizona law.
And there are other states that are considering adopting the same kinds of legislation.
And Susan, I think, can talk about this. But look at the USA Today Gallup polling that's out there. You know, again, I think that the most stunning number is probably the fact that 31% of people either had no opinion or who had never heard of this law, which always reminds me that we assume that everything that happens in Washington, related to Washington, is paid attention to as deeply as we pay attention to it by the American public. It's not. But that showed 39% support, 31% opposition to the Arizona law. You know, I've heard interviews with Arizona Republican lawmakers who say, we're fine with the scorn from national. Look at polling. It suggests that people are supportive of it. There's a silent majority in this country that agrees with us. We'll see how that plays out.
So what happens in the meantime? The Arizona law simply stands. Arrests could be made. Deportations could happen.
Well, there are 90 days. The law doesn't take effect until 90 days after the Arizona legislature adjourns. So we're looking at sometime during the summer, the law would go to effect. And with the number of lawsuits that are promised, it's entirely possible that enforcement of the law is going to be delayed until this gets sorted out in the courts. One argument that could be made is that it's unconstitutional for Arizona to enact a law like this because immigration is a federal matter. There's this doctrine of preemption that prevents states from doing things the federal government is supposed to do. Now, people in Arizona would say the federal government's not doing their job in controlling immigration, but I don't think that this. I don't think we've heard the last word on this law yet.
Gary?
I think that's right. I'm no legal expert, but I think it's very likely there would be a court somewhere in that 90-day period that will issue a stay that will stop the law from going into effect, and then we'll see what happens. I think it's worth noting, though, that there is, to a lot of people, there's a common sense aspect to this Arizona law in which they say, well, look, it's illegal. They're here illegally. Why shouldn't a police officer find out if they're here illegally and send them back? And, oh, by the way, in an environment in which, you know, we're hearing about drug gangs in Mexico coming across the border and robbing Texas ranchers in their home at gunpoint or kidnapping them, that we got a problem here, and somebody got to do something about it. It happens to be worse in Arizona than anywhere else, which probably explains why it's going on.
And one of the big opponents of the bill are law enforcement agencies that worry that, number one, it'll be a whole new set of things they're supposed to be doing, but also that it'll make it hard for them to go into an immigrant community and get the trust of people there to be willing to help them on really serious crimes like murders and drugs.
And just one more layer of the complexity of the politics of this issue. Look at some of the Republicans who have spoken out against it. Rick Perry, not exactly a moderate. Marco Rubio in Florida, Jeb Bush. These are not, you know, these are conservative leaders who are concerned about this bill's impact both on immigration but also on the politics for the Republican Party.
Chris DeLisa, Susan Page, Jerry Seib. They'll answer your questions when we come back.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the German Embassy and the German Information Center, whose Germany.info publishes news about politics, culture, and lifestyle at Germany.info. By the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, working to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. And by the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR.
The EU and IMF seek to address the debt crisis in Europe. Britain holds its final pre-election debate, and the leaders of India and Pakistan meet for the first time in months. The Diane Rehm Show, next hour. And welcome back. A number of you have pointed out, as Thomas from Erieville, New York, has said, that Exxon has not yet paid the fines that were assigned to them. Can we expect the same from BP?
I seriously doubt it. I think we're in a different environment. And as I said, my sense of the BP response is that this is a corporation that's coming from a different place.
All right. And one caller who identifies himself as an illegal alien working in Florida says he tried to come legally many times It's impossible to get a visa, even as a tourist. They ask about assets and your work. People wanting work don't usually have that. It's tough. Tough to get in.
You know, there's the hard thing about the issue, Diane, is that, and Jerry mentioned this earlier, you had George W. Bush and John McCain pushing quite hard for this. And don't forget that at one point you had John McCain and Ted Kennedy, the late Senator Kennedy, pushing each on their end. Now, you can argue about John McCain's influence within the Republican conference, but it's hard to argue about Ted Kennedy's influence within the Democratic caucus. And yet we saw it implode. In fact, we didn't just see it implode as an issue. We saw it almost cost John McCain the Republican presidential nomination. So the hard thing is that it is an issue where there is deep passion and deeply held belief on both sides of it. And that's what's very difficult to try and get to any sort of compromise solution because people just are sort of set in their ways and not particularly ready to change their opinions.
All right, let's go to Houston, Texas. Good morning, Sylvia. You're on the air.
I have a concern that the profiling issue is not limited only to police, that anybody in the public that suspects that they see illegal immigrants can call 911, and the police will be required by law to respond and start asking people for citizenship. And there are plenty of U.S. citizens in Arizona who are going to be speaking Spanish or listening to Spanish music and who might look illegal to someone else.
I heard a young woman of Hispanic origin talking yesterday on All Things Considered, saying she was afraid to walk out the door wearing her usual casual blue jeans or whatever. She was going to have to be far more careful. Does our caller have a legitimate concern?
You know, I think so. If this law goes into effect and it's against the law and the police have a right to demand papers if there's a reasonable suspicion, I assume that it's entirely possible that people could call in with a complaint and expect the police to respond.
All right. To Louisville, Kentucky. Good morning, Joe. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Another beautiful day in the bluegrass here.
Good.
Those people will be swimming in the infield tomorrow. anyway, I wanted to talk about the Goldman Sachs fiasco up on Capitol Hill. You know, years ago, I want to remind everybody that George Bush and the Republicans wanted us to take our money, basically, and transfer from Social Security into the private market there on Wall Street and just ride it out and hope for the best. Well, that kind of sort of happened back in 97, and we lost a tremendous amount in our 401ks and our retirement plans, and then a lot of people were wiped out again right now. So I'm not quite sure why people think that we have such a socialist government. I would rather trust a socialist government than these Wall Street con men. I just don't understand why people think that's the way to go, especially after the way they exhibited themselves in the Capitol Hill hearings the other day.
All right, Joe, thanks for calling. Jerry, I've got an email for you from Paul, who says Jerry Sives' rationalization on market making is no different from a supermarket selling poisoned food. Food it knows is poisoned, and saying we did not poison the food. We just found out people who wanted to sell the food and people who wanted to buy the food, and we have no obligation to let the buyers know about the dangers. The buyer should have tested the food before they ate it. How can a grown-up assert such a silly position,
well,
Jerry?
Well, first of all, I was explaining, not rationalizing. It's what you saw in the hearing. If you watched the hearing, it was fascinating because the argument that the emailer makes is pretty much the one the senators were trying to get the Goldman Sachs people to acknowledge and engage on, and they simply wouldn't do it. They looked at the senators as if they were from, as Susan said, a different planet, because that's not in their mentality. It's not what they – I mean, the Wall Street view of this is that making a market is in and of itself a good activity because it allows commerce to flow. Now, you can agree or disagree with that. I'm agnostic on that. But anyway, that was the explanation, not the rationalization. All right. Just one other point, though. Sure. I've actually kind of wondered why more people haven't gone in political terms to this point about Social Security and partial privatization, which we debated endlessly in this town back in the early part
We've
of this decade.
We've talked about it.
It is not really caught on. I suspect there are many Republicans who are just as happy that all that cup passed. Now.
Absolutely. To Statesville, North Carolina. Good morning, David.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
The point on the illegal immigration that infuriates me is these people are here illegally. They are breaking the law by being here. And if they are caught, they need to be sent back and try to get in legally. I know it's hard to get into this country. There's a reason for that. It's a great country. But, it just blows me away that people can sit there and say, you know what, we need the work done. We need this done. Americans won't do it. For one thing, yes, they will. If the jobs are there, yes, they will. They just won't do it for $5 an hour.
All right, David, just to give you another perspective on that very issue, here's an email from Doris who says most Americans want illegal immigrants out of the country, but no one is willing to pay higher prices for the cost of food and services.
You know, I think Jerry mentioned this earlier, and the caller David is referencing it. It's the common sense argument, which is, if you break the law, then why can't we pass a law that says we can enforce it? And I think that is a very strong strain within this country. I do think people who dismiss what happened in Arizona as the work of a small group of conservative Republicans and then the signing of the law by a governor who faces a significant primary challenge from her right, all of those things are true. But I do not think that in any way invalidates what David is talking about, that there is a significant group of people in this country who say, well, wait a minute, why are we the bad guy for trying to get rid of people who are breaking the law?
All right, to St. Louis, Missouri. Good morning, David.
Good morning. My comment is that I continually hear comparisons between BP and the government's response to Katrina. And the citizens of the Ninth Ward are arguably the poorest of the poor and had zero resources available to them. In contrast, BP made $6 billion in the last quarter alone. I would think that there's not quite an apples-to-apples comparison as to the resources available to the two groups. I'll take my comment off the air.
All right. Thanks.
Well, you make a good point, David. But keep in mind that BP is going to be on the hook for the expenses of this federal action. That's not to say that the federal government shouldn't have been more on the ball when Katrina struck New Orleans.
Is BP going to pay for
Navy
ships? Because
they certainly should have been.
Is BP?
I think that the costs associated with the cleanup are going to be billed to BP.
I'm not sure. But, there is a difference here. I mean, Katrina is an act of God, and the oil platform blowing up is arguably an act of BP. That's a difference that's significant in this case, and we'll see how it plays out.
We've had many emails like this one from Brian in San Antonio. He says, why is it that when the government goes all hands on deck to stop a disaster like the oil spill, we applaud the government's intervention? When they move to intervene to stop the collapse of the financial sector, people kick and scream about government takeover and expansion.
Well, it's interesting because a better question, I think, similar but better question is, why do people want the government to act after disaster has struck, and why do they always complain when they do things to stop disaster from striking? It's an illogical reaction. I think the Obama administration answer to that would at least be that in the long run, we're going to get more credit than we have gotten so far for responding to the financial meltdown in 2008, 2009. Because it will look better in retrospect than it did at the time.
And in fact, it looks pretty good this morning. We had new growth figures for the first quarter, 3.2%. That's, I think, the third quarter third consecutive quarter of growth, another sign that we're pulling out of this terrible recession, and that will rebound to some degree to the credit of the administration.
Let's talk about Charlie Crist, Susan. What's he doing?
What a political saga this has been. Well, he was the lead pipe cinch to be the next senator from Florida. He was no question he could win the Republican primary. This was just a couple months ago. Now, yesterday he announced he had decided to run as an independent. That's because it was clear he was going to lose the Republican primary to Marco Rubio, who is this year's political phenom. And it makes it for this an interesting three-way race in this big state, big important state. At least two of the three people who are running for Senate there think they ought to be president. You know, I think Marco Rubio thinks he's on a presidential track. Charlie Crist used to. Maybe he still does. And the Democratic candidate in that race is a Congressman Kendrick Meek.
So what difference is it likely to make that Charlie Crist has become an independent?
The answer to that, Diane, is we don't know. You know, if you look at polling that was done in advance of Charlie Crist's announcement, which in very typical Charlie Crist fashion, he denied he had made right up until he made it. It suggested that this was, as Susan mentioned, a very legitimate three-way race with Charlie Crist and Marco Rubio in the sort of low 30s, Kendrick Meek, who's significantly less known, Miami area congressman, an African-American congressman from that area, in the 20s. The question is in a partisan race where lots of money is going to be spent on both sides, is there room in the middle even for someone as well-known and up until recently as popular as Governor Crist? What usually happens in federal races, not always, but typically, partisans come home the closer they get to the election. They think of themselves as an independent, but they ultimately usually vote for Republicans. And can Charlie Crist preserve enough of the middle to be viable? I'll tell you one person who hopes he can, Kendrick Meek, because that gives Kendrick Meek a real chance to win.
I think that's the key here is, you know, the history of these things in the last generation has been that independent candidates look good for a while and then inevitably fade at the end. If that doesn't happen this year, it'll tell you two things. A, it'll tell you Charlie Crist found more money to finance himself than people think he will, and B, that this is a different political climate. But you look at the history of the last generation, you say the odds are not good that it'll work out
and
that way.
Just, Diane, one other quick thing. I do think this does point to the power of the anger of the conservative base of the party. The conservative base of the party, Charlie Crist, as Susan mentioned, was without question, the scepter was laid on his shoulders by national Republicans that he was going to be the nominee. Well, Marco Rubio started to win straw polls in the state. Everybody dismissed it. Oh, that doesn't matter. Well, it actually did matter. And all of a sudden we saw a governor who was at 68% popularity go from 30 points ahead to 30 points behind.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. And now to Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning, Michael. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to respond to Jerry's comment earlier about the fact that he didn't feel that the financial services regulation bill should be debated on the Senate floor. And I feel that, you know, given how calamitous the whole crisis was, that it's critical that it be debated openly and that all senators have a say in the bill. And one of his arguments for not doing it publicly was that it's too complicated for a lot of these senators to understand. And I would challenge that on two fronts. Number one, the math behind derivatives is too complicated, but the financial services industry can be explained at a conceptual level. The average person can understand it if someone will just explain it in plain English. And number two, I feel that it's such a serious issue that it's about time that everyone learn about it so they can make a wise decision.
Yeah, I think Michael makes a good point. And what I was really saying was that some of the fine-tuning should have been done on the banking committee, which took a total pass on this, voted it out in about half an hour's debate, and let it be dealt with in private negotiations, which broke down. I mean, so the process, I think, isn't working right. Michael's absolutely right. It should be debated on the Senate floor. I'm just saying some of the fine-tuning would have been better done with a smaller group of people, not in private, but in public, at a committee that's set up to do exactly that, and didn't happen.
Somebody has sent an email saying, why has no one mentioned the constitutional right of citizens to refuse showing documentation to the police when questioned?
Because, and of course, we have a history in this globe of being uncomfortable with police being able to go up and demand papers from somebody who's on the street. Now, the Arizona law says you have to have a reasonable suspicion that they're not here legally. But as you, the question you raised at the very beginning, Diane, how do you get a reasonable suspicion that this person on the street is not here legally?
And what? And how do you make reasonable suspicion be an objective rather than subjective measure? I mean, that's one man's reasonable suspicion is another man's just let him.
But
can
a citizen deny the police if the police comes up to him and says, I want to see your ID? The guy or girl could say, sorry, I'm not going to show it to you, or not?
Well, I think that's what the courts will decide that. I mean, there's now a law in Arizona that says they can do that, and I think we'll find out. It's a fascinating commentary on Huffington Post this morning written by Desmond Tutu, the Nobel Peace Prize winner from South Africa, who talked about what happened in the culture in South Africa when this sort of thing was allowed to happen. And I'm not sure, you know, a lot of people will say that that's apples and oranges, but it's an interesting point that he talked about what it does to the attitude of the police who are put in a position of having to do this sort of thing, and they don't want to do it. And that's probably true to a large extent in this country as well.
How great is it that we can read what Desmond Tutu thinks about the Arizona law on the Huffington Post?
It's a great country.
It's a great country with lots of people contributing. And our very special contributor this morning, Jerry Seib of the Wall Street Journal, Susan Page of USA Today, and Chris Deliza, whose new job is managing editor of postpolitics.com. He's also author of The Fix on WashingtonPost.com. Thanks for listening, all. Have a great weekend. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, and Monique Nazareth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dory Annisman answers the phones.